We have a lot of guests to welcome tonight, so we'll go in order of how far you traveled, okay? Ian, welcome from Melbourne. Where are you at these days, Kevin? Still Melbourne, so we got two Melbourneites with us. And where's Fred? Fred, welcome from Hollywood, Florida. Welcome, thank you for joining us. And of course, we've got our three visitors from the five towns, a place in New York. Okay, welcome, welcome. Okay, so the beginning of the parsha sounds like a whole new introduction. Of course, the steady Los Angeles visitors, okay, steady Los Angeles team. Sounds like a whole new beginning. Hashem had already dispatched Moshe. Moshe already tried. And now the parsha begins as if nothing happened before. Hashem comes to Moshe, Vayirah Avraham el Yitzchak ve'el Yaakov bekel Shakai u'shmi Hashem lo nodati lahem. Haven't you been paying attention? I was at the snow. You told me who you were. You told me how to release the Jewish people. I tried. This is the second round. Vayirah should begin. Go back. Go back, champ. Get back into the ring. Give it a second shot. Sounds like a whole new beginning. So part of the reason there's a new beginning is because there's a part of Moshe's story we don't see. Chazal say that between the end of Shmos and the beginning of Vayirah, Moshe actually fled Mitzrayim. He ran back to Midian. He was so embarrassed and so ridiculed and so frustrated by being hooted at and mocked that he actually ran back to Midian either for 3 months or 6 months. Guys, come, please take sheets and quietly sit down. 3 months or 6 months. And he had to re-enter the process in the beginning of Vayirah. Now, could you imagine if you were living through that scene? You'd been working for 200 years, not you, because he... but your grandparents, and all you knew was slavery. And finally a man comes and promises Geula, and everyone rallies around him, and he gets a little bit over his skis, and everyone laughs at him. And what would you say? Oh, it must be this is a false Messiah. This is a fake Redeemer. That Moshe, he was a Shabtai Tzvi. Wasn't real. After all, he came, flash in the pan, ran back to Midian, it's finished. A little bit of 20/20 hindsight, and it was just a 3 month or a 6 month pause in the process of Geula. What's 3 months or 6 months in the span of history? It's nothing. It's like a whisper. Part of the power of the last century is the juxtaposition between the Holocaust and between Medinas Yisrael. 3 years. 3 years between the lowest moment in Jewish history, the greatest Chilul Hashem since the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and the greatest triumph in 200 years, the return of Am Yisrael to their homeland, to their ancient homeland. Now, don't let anyone try to play one off against the other, chas v'shalom, to justify one based on the other. We don't know the ways of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but we do know what 3 years means. And in the sweep of history, 3 years is nothing. And as you grow older, you'll realize that, because for you, 3 years still means a lot. As you start growing older, 3 years starts to lose its proportion, lose its impact. So if you were living through Mitzrayim and you saw Moshe run away for 3 months, you just assume it's finished. And then 3 months later, he comes back. And 3 months later, Vayirah Avraham el Yitzchak ve'el Yaakov. And 3 months later, Dam Tzperneach. And 3 months later, Uvnei Yisrael Yatzu Biyad Rama. So sometimes Geula happens all at once, but most times in life it happens in stages. For whatever reason, Hashem chose that when he redeems his people, it doesn't always happen immediately. It's a struggle. There are starts and stops and lags and pauses and even regressions. Think of our second Geula. When Koresh requisitioned the construction of the Beis HaMikdash, and the Jews came back to Eretz Yisrael, and they met with a lot of opposition from the locals who were angry at Jewish expansionism. Sound familiar? And they wrote letters back to to Koresh. How can these Jews settle their occupiers? Apartheid. They're abusing the locals. And Koresh withdrew the approval. And 18 years had to pass until we returned with Ezra and Nehemiah and rebuilt the Beis HaMikdash in its totality. And in those 18 years, the Nes of Purim happened, but we'll talk about that when Purim time comes. Because you can't just read about Purim in a bottle. It's not a vacuum. It participates in the flow of Jewish history and the return to our land. Without Purim, we don't make it back. And without the need to make it back, there's no need for Purim. Purim is not just an arbitrary miracle in the middle of nowhere. It has a unique and particular historical function. And now we're in that same process. And it's drips and drabs. It starts and stops. And no one knows where this is heading.
And no one knows how quickly we'll get there, and no one knows. We know one thing. We've returned. Millions of Jews have started to build their home. Now we have the opportunity to contribute to Geula, not just in theory, as we've done for 2,000 years, because Geula didn't start 75 years ago. It started the time the last Jew left Yerushalayim and performed the first mitzvah. Because every blat gemara and every davening and every chesed is contributed to Geula. It's a cumulative effect. It's a conglomeration. But now we can contribute not just conceptually, metaphysically, but now we can contribute actually. We can build homes, build a country, build a government, and build an army, and build infrastructure, and create welfare. So when Mashiach comes, we'll say, hey, we did most of your work for you. Look at the country we've built. Look at the people we've assembled. We have to make some changes that we may not be able to make on our own. It may take hundreds of years, but we started the process. And just because there are moments of frustration, Mirz Hashem, we shouldn't have them. I lived through a lot worse than Mirz Hashem you'll have to live through. I lived through the 90s. I lived through the 2s. I lived through a lot of the Lebanon War. Baruch Hashem, the last 15, 20 years of Eretz Yisrael have been just jubilant and almost unending successes in every sector. We're expanding militarily, economically, politically, culturally. It's hard to see setbacks. Baruch Hashem, Hashem has chosen the last 15, 20 years to give us the type of bracha that we can never dream of. But who knows what he'll decide and what he'll determine in the future. And just because we give up some land, I'm not saying we should or we shouldn't. This is not a political statement. Just because there are things that seem to be a setback doesn't mean the process ends. It means the process delays, the process stalls, the process lags. I can't answer. We don't have a Masara for Geula. That's the problem. We have a Masara for Tefillin. Look up in the Shulchan Aruch. Look in the Gemara. We have a Masara for how to eat matzah. We have a Masara for the Isra Nevela. We have a Masara for Nazirus. We have a Masara for Halacha. We don't, by definition, have a Masara for Geula. Because it hasn't happened before. When it happened in totally different circumstances. Then we wrote a Shulchan Aruch and Geula. So you have to have a Munah HaKadosh Baruch Hu, keep your eyes open. Don't assume you can predict every detail, but understand that there's a general flow and a general spirit that you feel you want to be part of and you want to contribute to. So there's a new start in Vayera. And it's a new start because of a episode that happens right at the juncture between Shmuel and Vayera that we didn't really see. But now there is a new start. And as part of that new start, that new launch, Hashem introduces himself to Moshe in a way that the Avos of Sefer Bereishis never saw him. Number one, Bekel Shakai. When I appear to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, I appeared as Kel Shakai. Now, that's not only the word that appears in Bereishis, but Shakai appears a lot in Bereishis, and then afterwards, not so much. If you're following, keeping score, Shakai, Shin Dalad Yud, is a Bereishis word. Hinton, it also appears in Rus and Eov, but that's a whole different story why Rus and Eov have the word Shakai. But the more popular, ubiquitous name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Yudkei Vavkei, it also appears, by the way, here in their Bereishis, but it starts to dominate in Shmos. Now, we're not going to talk tonight about the difference between Shakai and Yudkei Vavkei. It's very philosophical, it's very deep. There are extensive Rambams and extensive Mefarshim in this week's Parsha. But one thing is clear from the Pasuk, that Yudkei Vavkei is an upgrade. The Avos received Shakai. They didn't receive Yudkei Vavkei. That's why Hashem is telling Moshe, Shmi Hashem Lanu Dati Lahem. They saw me through the lenses of Shakai. You're going to see me through the lenses of Yudkei Vavkei. What does Moshe deserve at this early stage in his career? Why does Moshe get this upgrade? Out of nowhere, he gets his business class upgrade. You know, business class. Imagine him on the way home, they upgrade you to business. He'd be a happy man, right? Very happy. Why did he get the upgrade? What does he deserve? The Melech, let's say this happens in Parshas Hazino. After all the tefillos, and after all the miracles, and after Har Sinai, and after, okay, you deserve to see more of me than others because you've pursued me throughout your whole life. You've tried to inquire about me. You've studied me. You've behaved like me. This is your testimony. This is your lifetime achievement award. You're going to see more of me than others. But this is an early stage Moshe. We saw Moshe in last week's Parsha. He's uncertain. He's rickety. He's underconfident. Should he take the job? Should he not take the job? He doubts Am Yisrael. He doubts his own ability. This is not Moshe in all of his glory. It's not the final product. And yet at this early stage, but you. And the answer comes in the next couple of psukim, which you can read. It's now time for me to make good on my promise and my oath. And I swore to people before there was a nation. There were just individuals, just a few people. Look how individuals can change the world. Just think about how Bereishis segues to Shmos. Individuals change the world. Small, quiet, courageous decisions like we spoke about last week. Avram discovered Hashem. By Shema, all of a sudden, there's a people, millions of people. I promised them, but now I have to make good on those promises because now there's a people. Those people in Bereishis, for all of their courage and all of their faith, they were raising families. Families are easy. Not always, but they're easy. You all live together under the same roof. You all share the same resources. You fight, but no one's going anywhere. I want us to stay together. Certain limits of the fight. I remember during Corona how sensitive I was. We were locked into the home for weeks and weeks and weeks at a time. So better not let these fights escalate because no one's going anywhere. We can fight and scream and shout. If anyone gets to the next level, DEFCON 5, you have to sit around the table together. Well, that's what family's like anyway. So everyone wants to get along. There's no great sacrifice in raising a family. A nation, it's a whole different ballgame. It's a whole different story. When you're raising a people, that requires dedication, devotion, self-annihilation. That requires a whole different level of commitment that the Avos were never asked to execute. They were raising children, raising wives. It's family. Moshe now is going to be tested. And Moshe's already proven the dedication in the early stages of Moshe. That's what his life will be like. And Parshas Vayera establishes the following riddle. You wouldn't think it's true. You would think that to see more of Hashem, you have to sever yourself from people, from Am Yisrael. Because Am Yisrael will just get in the way. They'll just pollute you. They'll just obstruct Hashem because there's so many sinners and so many failures. And let me find a stark place of purity where I can see more of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's not HaKadosh Baruch Hu's message to Moshe. You're going to have a large people that you'll be dealing with, saints and sinners, Erev Rav and Sadiqim, needs that are spiritual and needs that are ridiculous, and you're going to have to deal with them all. And if you show greater dedication, you're going to see more of me. And you're seeing more of me is not going to be a prize or a reward because you're so dedicated to Hashem. It's going to be a reality because part of the way we see Hashem and build a relationship with Him because we can't know Him. You want to try to see Hashem this way? Good luck with that. Your head is not built to understand Hashem. The processors in your head are completely, completely asynchronous with Hashem. There's no way your head can understand Hashem. Hashem is infinite. What does infinity mean to you? You don't even know. Try to close your eyes and think of infinity. Half of you are doing the math sign, and the other half aren't the math geeks who think about Star Wars. Maybe you're thinking the introduction to Star Wars, right? That's not infinity. That's big black space. I can't describe infinity to you because my processors don't allow it. I think in finite structures. My mind thinks structured, beginning and end. That's how we're wired. Kadosh Baruch Hu is indivisible. What do you know in this world is indivisible? Nothing. This table can be broken down to atoms, subatoms, quarks. Just imagine how much energy can be released if I create a nuclear fusion by smashing atoms. How much energy I can release that can destroy the world. So everything can be subdivided. Nothing in this world is indivisible except for the Ribbono Shel Olam. So try understanding what indivisibility is. Try to understand what non-physical is. Everything in this world is physical, except for concepts. But Hashem's not a concept. Hashem's a being. So our minds are complete that maybe your philosophy can help, maybe it can enrich. So some of the way we understand Hashem is listening to His voice. Some of the way we understand Hashem is having Him listen to our voice. We call that davening. Some of the way we understand Hashem is try to craft our behavior like Him. That's called chesed. I want to try to turn myself into someone that behaves like Him. But you know another way we understand more of Hashem? We see and we associate with people who also love Hashem. And that's why if you really want to test your avodas Hashem, you have to test your Avas Yisrael. Avas Yisrael is a good litmus for avodas Hashem on every level. First of all, first and foremost, David HaMelech says in Tehillim, Parakuf Yutes, Chaver Ani, in the Cheses, 8 psukim for each letter, Chaver Ani L'chol Asher Yireucha. I am a friend to all other people who are trying to be Yirei Shemayim. How do you view people that are from, committed, dedicated to Torah, dedicated to mitzvah, but slightly different Ashkafa from you? Do you get caught up on the details, the small details that divide? We say, wow, we share so much in common. I want to put on tefillin. I want to do mitzvahs. I want to study Torah. I want to understand the Ribbono Shel Olam. And you know, so does that person. There are a couple issues that everyone likes to talk about, but They're really not more important than the meat. Really not more important than the essence. And it's not just a test for your tolerance. It's a test for how deeply, deeply you care about something. Because when you care about something very deeply, you're willing to round off the areas of difference. So let's say you and your friend really, really enjoy, I don't know, watching football together, but he likes tacos and you like pretzels and, oh, my goodness, we can't watch together. No, because the game is more important than the food. So you'll finesse the food, the tacos and pretzels, whatever. But if you invert that, then, so what do you really care about? What really, really excites you? Is it Torah and mitzvos and avodas Hashem? And you say, hey, that person also is excited about Torah. So they differ in dress, are they different in language, are they different? What's the essence? What's at the core? And not only avodas Hashem to people that are sincerely interested in Frumkeit as you are, but avodas Yisrael for every Jew, because Hashem chose every Jew. And even if, let's say you had chas v'shalom, a sibling in your family, who weren't in line with the family, or however you'd call that in line, it's still your brother, still your father's child, your mother's child. So even if that person's a little bit wayward, if you really care for the family structure and for the family dynamic and for your parents who care, then you care about everyone. You don't leave anyone out. So Moshe is entering this new, uncharted territory called Avas Yisrael. There's no Avas Yisrael in Sefer Bereishis, because there's no Yisrael in Sefer Bereishis. There's no Yisrael to love. That whole process or challenge only emerges in Shmos. It isn't a challenge in Bereishis. Everyone's family. Get along, don't get along. You know what I'm saying? Family can't live without them, you can't shoot them. Okay, so everyone's either getting along or not getting along. But there's no challenge of Avas Yisrael. Well, then at this point there is. And Hashem is creating a template. He says, if you want to see more of me, be more dedicated, not less dedicated. Don't walk away to your ivory tower. Don't sever yourself from the people because they'll just impede you or distort it. Part of the way you love me is by loving my people. Part of the way you love me is by appreciating my people. Part of the way you love me is by loving the people that I love. Think about that as love. Mitzvah, one day you all fall in love. Part of the definition of love is loving the loves of your partner. Understanding what excites them, even though it may not excite you, and either appreciating it, loving it, depending on your level of investment, because that shows the person you care. It's not just about my interest, but about your interest. And then I'm part of your life. I'm not just your companion sitting along the same table. So if you superimpose a love between two people to a love between Am Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because Hashem wants us to superimpose that. So I have to say, what does Hashem love? What is Hashem's interest? And that has to be important to me. This becomes the theme of Moshe's life. At every stage that he shows greater dedication, he sees more of Hashem. Remember before Har Sinai, when Moshe walks into the fire, when Moshe Allah Elohim, and everyone's terrified of the smoke, and Moshe just casually walks into Moshe Nigash Al Harafel, Shoshem Elohim. Why does Moshe merit such casual encounter with Hashem when everyone's terrified and knee shaking beneath? Because what happens before Har Sinai? Yisro comes, and he sees Moshe. He sees Moshe spending every single second dealing with what are the big needs. This is before the Torah was given. What, they had a question in Miko? They didn't know what Miko is. They didn't have the Torah yet. That Svek Sveka, they didn't know what a Svek Sveka was. Everything was a Svek Sveka to them. What are the big questions? So Rav Amital told us the following story to help us better understand. Rav Amital's favorite stories in Parshas Yisro. May not be able to teach you Parshas Yisro, be in Los Angeles. Be in Boca, right? So, Parshas Yisro. Ramitel told us the story of a chassid, chassidish Rebbe. And all the chassidim would come to ask for the Rebbe's advice. So, 12 o'clock at night, a chassid goes running into the room, Rebbe, meine Tochter, my daughter, Zidafta Shidduch, she needs a Shidduch. Oh, Zidafta, Dafta Shidduch. Say some Tehillim, give some Tzedakah, learn some Mishnayos, Meseches Kiddushin, and to school your daughter will have a Shidduch. Then the next chassid comes in at 12:45, Rebbe, mein Weibe, Zidafta Refuah Shleima, she needs a Refuah Shleima. So she says, oh, your wife needs a Refuah Shleima. Say some Tehillim. Give some tzedakah, learn some mishnayos, meseches ksuvos, beinish leishto. She'll have a refuah shleima. It's now 2 a.m. and a chassid comes in, Rabbi, Rabbi, chatnishkein parnasa. I don't have any way to make a living. What am I going to do? Rabbi sits him down and says, okay, didafta parnasa, say some tehillim, give some staka, learn some mishnayas, bav mitzia, you'll have a parnasa, skula. Finally, it's 3:30 a.m. and the Rebbe and the Shamish are on their way home. And the Rebbe's exhausted. He's been up all day. And they're walking home through the cold streets of Poland. And a crazy-eyed chassid with his hair all over the place comes screaming down the block, Rebbe, who is the Rebbe? Who is the Rebbe? I need the Rebbe. Chdaf the Rebbe. And the Shamish says, the Bistam Meshuganek, game. You're crazy. Go on. Rebbe Shangan Shlom. The Rebbe already went to sleep. The Bistam Meshuganek, get away. I need the Rebbe. So the Rebbe says, let him come. So the chassid sits down with the Rebbe on a cold park bench at 3:45. Rebbe says, what can I do for you? Chassid says, Rebbe, I know what I'm going to do. My cow has an ear-splitting headache. How am I going to solve my cow's ear-splitting headache? So the Rebbe looks him in the eye and says, oh, your cow has an ear-splitting headache. Oy, oy, oy. Say something to Hillel. Give some staka, learn some mishnayos, maybe para. Your cow are for shalim. It's now 4 a.m, and the shamish is tucking the Rebbe in, pulling up the blankets. And the shamish says, I can understand the woman who needs a for shalima, and the daughter who needs a shidduch, and the men who need a parnasa, but you have nothing better to do at 4 a.m. than deal with this chassid, and his pashtuk and a cow, and his crazy attic. So the Rebbe says, you don't understand. You don't understand. He didn't want to speak about his cow. He wanted to talk to me. The cow? That was just a pretense. He didn't want to talk about the cow. He wanted to spend time with me. People want time. Sometimes they know how to ask for your time. Sometimes they don't know how to ask for your time and they make a pretense. Part of the art of being a father, you'll all realize one day, is knowing when your kids need you. And the way they ask may not be, I need you. The way they ask may be some other way. You need to learn to decode their request as, I just want to spend time together with you. That's what Moshe was doing. They didn't have big kashas. They were just slaves. What do they have? Hilchos Avodah, they learned the Mishnah, Hilchos Avodah. What do they really know? They just want to spend time with Moshe. They were frightened. They were uncertain about the future. Yisrael's terrified. Navol Tibol, you're going to fall apart. You're going to burn out. The great fear of modern Orthodox parents. My kid can't come back, Shenebek, because he's going to burn out. We're so afraid of burning out that we never begin to burn. We never begin to take flight. No one in this room, you may not want to come back, Shenebek, for all sorts of reasons. No one in this room is ever, ever, for the rest of your life, in danger of burning out. Burning out means you grew up in Mea Shearim. You didn't read newspapers, you never watched movies, you never had big meals, you never went to summer camp, and all you did your whole life was, if you were a Jew, learn Gemara Rashi tells us since you were 3, or if you're John Stuart Mills, who also burned out, learn Latin at the age of 3. Namely, if you had this one-track life, and you have any diversity in your life, there's a chance you may fall off a cliff. Everyone in this room has had a well-balanced diet, you've been across the world, you've seen people, you have a wealth of experience, you read, you have cell phones, you have... No one has to worry, oh my goodness, I can't learn the extra hour, I can't spend an extra year. There may be other reasons, other factors. It's not a pro shana bet. It is, but it's not an overtly pro shana bet. Okay? And we have to, for the privilege of our guests, for the information of our guests, right? Gush, the old saying is, we don't brainwash you. We just brainwash you into believing you're not being brainwashed. But we get it in there somehow, right? Subliminal or otherwise. But seriously, guys, take that concern off your plate. Maybe here or there, but in most cases, don't hold yourself back from intensity because you're afraid you're going to burn out. Maybe other areas don't hold yourself back from intensity. Maybe other areas of life where you'll burn out. But again, in most cases, you have enough wealth of experience in your past to fall back upon. Your friends, your social life, your camps, your parents, your movies, your phone. Burnout means all you do, you feel such pressure and you just have no outlet. And at some point it just explodes, and then you suffer a mental breakdown. It's not likely. That's not the issue we have to face in this room. Better to burn out than to fade away. Better to burn out. So Yisro's terrified. Navol Tibol. Moshe says, I can't. I got to be there. So what happens right afterwards? Moshe walks up the mountain. Every time Moshe recalibrates his dedication to Am Yisrael, his relationship with Hashem is recalibrated. And it's not a reward, it's a reality. Now, it doesn't seem to be true. I would think I would spend my entire day thinking about Hashem in a quiet room and reading Shas. That's my access to Hashem. It's not true. I access HaKadosh Baruch Hu by accessing him through his people. This was the great, great gift of Chassidus. If you want to whittle it down, what did Chassidus give our people? It entered history in a very dark and gloomy period where people had lost hope, where Am Yisrael had suffered the terrible, terrible massacres of the 17th century, the Khmelnytsky Rebellion. Did you look it up yet? Khmelnytsky Rebellion. And Am Yisrael felt that Galus was taking very, very long to unwind and to unfold. People didn't believe in themselves. People didn't believe in each other. It was one of the lowest points of Jewish history. And Chassidus came with a bold announcement called Avas Yisrael. In fact, some of the great Rebbeim were named by this farm. Anyone who wrote the Sefer Ohev Yisrael? The Abderav, one of the great Chassidus Rebbeim. And they excelled in Avas Yisrael. They excelled at just loving Jews. You don't see that today because Chassidus has become very insular. After the Holocaust, Chassidus became very, very retracted because Chassidus underwent traumas. Chassidus never knew the traumas it was facing because Chassidus created a coded society which was built for insular life in Europe to protect. And because of secularization and because of mass exodus of Jews from faith, we tend to glorify the yeshiva world, and it is a glorious experience, and we, Baruch Hashem, are the products of the yeshiva world, and our world is rich, but don't sugarcoat the past. Life in Eastern Europe in the early 20th century, for every one boy that made it to a yeshiva, nine people walked out of Judaism. People were defecting from Judaism en masse. Coming to America, giving it all up. Moving to Berlin, giving it all up. Moving to South Australia, giving it all up. And just taking on the form of their surroundings. It's a very, very hard period. So all of a sudden, Chassidus, which talks about this embracing view of the Jewish people, that makes sense in the 18th century where there's one Jew is leaving the shtetl, questioning religion, say, bring him in. What happens when millions and millions of Jews are defecting out of history? Chassidus didn't envision that and became very, very protective in order to protect itself. And then on top of that, once the Holocaust tore through Chassidus, the Holocaust was grounded in Poland and Romania and Hungary, and Eastern Russia. That was ground zero for Chassidus. I mean, there were entire sects of Chassidus that were obliterated. Anyone ever know the Alexander Chassidim? They have a small outlet in Italy, but they're just basically torn apart. Major Chassidus has just basically disappeared. So it became very, very protective, very, very preservationist. Our people, our dress, our society. That's not what Chassidus was intended to be. If you want to get a glimpse of what real Chassidus was originally, look at Lubavitch. Lubavitch still has that feel of every Jew is welcome, and every Jew is precious, and every Jew has to be integrated, and every Jew has to put on tefillin, and every Jew has to be cared for. It's really something to behold. And Moshe starts that tradition. Every step, recalibration of Avas Yisrael, recalibration of his relationship with Hashem. What happens after the Egel Azav? Hashem says, Moshe, that's it. I'm finished with the Jewish people. Harif mimeni v'ashmida. Look at me. Hashem says, this is the pasuk. Don't daven anymore. Doesn't mean I don't want you to daven anymore. So Moshe davens. So of course Hashem, at some point in the davening, Hashem tells Moshe, I'm going to annihilate the Jewish people, then I'll start again, and you'll be the founding father. You'll be the Avram. Man, if Hashem came to me and told me I'll be the Avram, my face is on the silver dollar, tell me where to sign up. I'm happy for that one. And what does Moshe say? Nada. No chance. You take me, you get them. You don't take them, you don't have me. That's Moshe's way of saying, V'mayin, mecheni na misifucha shekha safta. If you plan on obliterating them, then I'm out. I'm out. And Hashem says, that is exactly what I wanted you to say. You got it. And then a few minutes later, in the parsha, Harini nas kivodecha, hodieni nas terechacha, Hashem takes Moshe and puts him benikras hatsur. And Hashem says, ani avir kol tuvi aponecha. I will now pass Moshe, that quiet second Har Sinai sees more of Hashem than any other human being ever alive. Ve'isas achara, he sees the back of Hashem, whatever that means. Hashem, Hashem, kel rachum v'chanun. Vayisyatsev imosham. That word imo, to be used about Hashem, vayisyatsev imo, that a human being could be im Hashem. Vayishatzev imo sham. Every moment that Moshe rises and it augments his love for the Jewish people, even if it's self-annihilating, he sees more of Hashem. And the reverse is also true. When he starts to lose some of that concern and some of that love, then he's retired. He doesn't get banned from Eretz Yisrael because he hits the rock. That's part of it, according to the Rambam. But according to Chazal, the reason he gets banned from Eretz Yisrael is because they're at the rock and he's angry. Source number hey, Vayikaru Moshe ve'Aaron esakal opnei hasela, Vayomer lahem, Shimu naha marim. What does the word marim mean? Hearts in a rebels, outcasts. At that point, it's over. At that point, you can fold it up. For the greatest leader of the Jewish people to sit in front of people who need him, who need his love, who need his understanding, and speak down to them, he's about to be retired. I can't tell you how many people tell me, you know I am not from today? Because I met the wrong rabbi at the wrong time. I was going through an illness, and I met some rabbi who just spoke down to me. I'm a woman, I was going through a hard divorce or niguna, and some rabbi spoke to me in a chauvinistic term. I was going through some dintara, and the rabbis acted selfishly and grubbishly. Or Orthodox Jews, for that matter. And it's not your fault. But when you think about Kiddush Hashem, it's not a question of whose fault it is. It's not like you want to escape the blame. It's not my fault. At the end of the day, it's results that count. And if people are going to be drawn away from Avodas Hashem because of you, or drawn away from religion because of you, that's not something you want to live with. To say that about another Jew, sometimes I hear the way politicians speak about other Jews and secular Jews, it's not worth it. Whatever platform you're trying to advance is not worth the way you speak about another Jew. Even Jews who aren't from, but who deeply, deeply, deeply identify with Judaism in ways that unfortunately are incomplete, but still a reflection of our original tradition. You don't think Jews who care about social justice feel that they're perpetuating Avram's tradition? Okay, there's much more than social justice. There's Torah, there's religion. And what about Jews who are totally lost in history? They have very little sense. Someone has to care for them. They don't care about their own Jewish identity. Someone's got to ratify. You expect them to discover their Jewish identity if you ridicule them or ignore them or... Well, Chas v'Shalom, when I heard this word, I mean, it made the news today in an odd way because there was a lady who was a little bit off, a little bit, obviously, not completely lucid to use this word about a big rub, but it just made the news. There's one word that if anyone ever uses that word out of context, that is a conversation stopper. You leave the room. Anyone who uses the word Nazi about anyone other than a Nazi, as far as, let alone a Jew, as far as I'm concerned, that conversation ends. Because to use the term Nazi, or for that matter, and I hate this term, people use it, I'm sure it's in Australia, the ghetto, the Jewish ghetto. I just can't use that term. I think of a ghetto, I think of people dying, having their beards cut off, being shot in the street, pregnant women being stabbed in the stomach, people dying of starvation, syphilis. How can I use that term about Jews who have 15 restaurants and 20 mikvahs and live in Robert's Peak or Robinson? Just, I can't. Okay, I know that it's innocuous. I know people don't mean it that way. But when it isn't used innocuously, when it's used disparagingly, there is no position that's worth using that word and disgracing the memory of people that live through hell. People that live through nightmarish conditions. Just watch your words. And Moshe didn't watch his words. Now, if you and I were to say that term, obviously at our madrega, at our level, it wouldn't register. We have so many other things that we're struggling with. But for Moshe, the radar is so finely tuned because for Moshe Rabbeinu, he's so close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the shift that happens in Vayera. The shift between a family and a people. The shift between homogeneity and heterogeneity. The shift between dealing with people who are all more or less rowing in the same direction and dealing with a raucous bunch of Erev Rav and rebels and Dustin and Avirams and being able to manage it and handle it and have a sweeping and broader ownership of what it is to be a Jew and what it is to care about Jews without, and here's the other problem, without it weakening and diluting your Avodas Hashem. How can it be something which intensifies your Avodas Hashem? How can you create a bigger tent without diluting? And that's hard. And communal level is hard. Who do you include? Who do you not include? There are many, many technical questions you can't answer because they're context specific and they differ from person to person. But attitudinally, your attitude, your care outside of a outside of a communal context, just because this is something we talk about, how do we deal with someone who's not firm? How do we deal with someone who's homosexual? How do, like, inclusion, non-inclusion? Oh, these are important questions. But beyond the context of a community where hard decisions have to be made, to be disparaging and disrespectful of other Yidden? So be careful. Think about Parshas Vayera as a chance to work in your Avas Yisrael. Everyone is from. People who are not from. Every Jew. It's not a Hasidish idea. It's a Moshe Rabbeinu idea. Hasidus reinforced it at a very particular, vulnerable point of history. Okay, so Moshe now comes. And he comes bearing promises of Gula. And somehow he flatlines. No one listens. V'loshe mo'a Moshe mi'kotze ruach u'mi'avodah kasha. So here's a chance for us to ask ourselves, why do people not listen in life? I don't even want you to listen to my instructions. Then I know why, because you disrespect me all the time. And I know Judah, you're the mom. I'm just teasing because you're looking at me. Why don't you listen to long-term issues? Why, like, why is it so hard to see the tea leaves? Why is it so hard to think ahead? Because that's what Moshe. So let's take a look at the Meshech Chachma. Meshech Chachma is Dvinsker Gadol, as we all know. I'll tell you a nice story about Meshech Chachma. Since we talked about harsh opinions, Reb Chaim was a very, very obstinate, fanatical, harsh believer in all of his opinions. I think it's genetic. Okay, when Reb Chaim had an opinion, my way or the highway. So he was once at a gathering of Gedolim in Europe, and he said his piece about whatever issue they were fighting about. You guys can't imagine how politically charged the years between 1870 and 1970 were. Like that 100 years of the big age of ideology and secularism and Zionism and Buddhism and college. Okay, bring it all down, guys. We're trying to all learn Torah, build our people, find some good kosher pizza shops. We don't have all these big fights about your camp and our camp and my camp. And just everyone, just keep it real. Okay? We're finished with the age of ideology. Let's just do me a favor. It's being over Hashem. You don't have to define yourself. You don't have to fight any battles. Just battles are finished. Now we just have to move forward. Let's get some momentum. So B'chaim went to one of these Gedolim gatherings, and the Dvinsker Rav, Rabbeinu Meir Simcha, got up to speak. I said, Dvinsker Rav, we're standing there, Meir Simcha. Chaim took his chair and put his back to Meir Simcha. Because he said, I so disagree with your position that I'm going to look at you. Turn the chair around. Okay, why am I telling the story? A few days later, Chaim was ready to leave the town. We go back home to Brisk. So it's Shamus, Shazam, whoever it was, said, okay, let's go home. Chaim said, before we go, we have to go say goodbye to the Meshech Chachma. You want to call him Meshech Chachma? The Dvinsker Rav. He says, Abba, you didn't look at him. You turned your chair. What are you saying goodbye to him? He says, what do you mean? He's the biggest gadol. I just don't agree with his policy. He's the gadol. To go say goodbye to him. Guys, one of the hallmarks of this yeshiva, okay, learn to disagree with a position without impugning the person. There's a person and there's a position. You can disagree with the position and respect the person. It seems very easy, guys, right? Good luck. It's not so easy. Because passion takes over, and you think that person is the greatest threat to the free world, and that position is going to kill the Jews. Okay, positions, people can have integrity. You know, positions that are different from you. Learn to disassociate the two. Learn to respect the human being if you disagree with the position. Another cute story about the Meshech Chachma. There was a Rav in Tbilisi, which is near Odessa. So the community of Yerushalayim invited him to be the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim around the turn of the century. There were tens of thousands of Jews in Odessa. There were very few Ashkenazim living in Yerushalayim around the turn of the century. Most of the Jews in Yerushalayim were Sephardic Jews. Right? Ashkenazic Jews had a hard time moving to Yerushalayim. In the early 18th century, there were a group of Ashkenazic Jews that tried to settle the old city, if you will, and it went south. They had big debts, and the Arab Mafia burnt down all their shuls. The horrible shul. It wasn't anti-Semitic. It was just defaulting on debts to the Mafia, which is worse than this. And for 200 years, Jews were not allowed to live in Yerushalayim if you were Ashkenazi because of the outstanding debt. So Jews who wanted to live in Yerushalayim had to dress up as Spartans. If you wanted to reach Yerushalayim. So by the end of the 19th century, it got a little easier, and Ashkenazi started by the 1850s and 60s, but they just wanted to make Ashkenazi Jews. So there's a letter that I have a copy of it at home where the people of Dvinsk write an angry letter to the community of Yerushalayim. What are you thinking? Who in the world would want to leave Dvinsk to be the rabbi of Yerushalayim? It's a little sinkhole with a few Jews. He's the rabbi of Dvinsk. Like, why would you leave Dvinsk to be? So like it's 120 years later, and that letter is a, you know, it's a one-liner. It's about Don't be like the people at Dvinsk. Don't be like the Dvinskers. Okay, guys, we're going to be on the right side of history. Trust me. Make sure you're on the right side of history. Dvinsk is the wrong side of history. I'll let you fill in the rest of the blanks. What else is the wrong side of history? They won't be the right side of history. So anyway, so Nesha Chachma says, okay, what did you say? Kiderach Sheyom, source number base. Asher Yachpitsu Lishmoa, Rakide Latses Mitzarasan, the low Lishmoa Bachtachos Asidos. It's hard. You're under a lot of pressure. You can't breathe. Kotze Ruach. And you're working so hard and you're moving so fast. You don't have time to think. Long-term thinking. Lost art. Moving so fast. Take a look tonight at a video. 1980. One of my videos. And then take a look at a music video from 2023. And compare the FPSs, frames per second. How much information your mind is processing every second? How many visuals? You also have to compare music videos. Think about, we didn't have WhatsApps, we didn't have Instagram, we didn't have to respond immediately, there was one phone per house. It was a slower life. It was a life of thinking and quiet. It was a life of poise. Such a fast, fast world. I told you so often, take the time to think. Less is more. Don't think that you'll get smarter by reading more. You'll get smarter by reading less and thinking about what you've read and internalizing and understanding it. Shave things away. Don't add things because it creates more noise and more distraction. Or footnote. Whatever, Machensin's Ravanim is a deep, deep thinker. Rav Hutner once saw Yeshiva Bachrim reading books on the bus. There was no phones. They were on the bus. They were being smart. They get angry at that. He said, why are you taking the time on the bus to read? You should be taking the time on the bus to think. Close the bus and think. You can only imagine what Rav Hutner would say to him. He said, just read the books. Please just read the books. Why take the time on the phone? What's a book? What's a book? It's called words. It's called ideas. Okay. 11 people try to justify. You know, at least be honest with yourself. I'm seeing a movie because it's lending depth to my life. Please. Please. You're seeing a movie because you enjoy it. You're allowed to enjoy it. But what do you mean, Inception, Rabbi? Please. You can open up any random book in the library. Here's the random book of the library. Go to any library. Open any random book. And just read two random pages in the random book, in the random library, and I promise you, you'll get 10 times the meaning of 50 movies combined. Line up 50 movies, whatever messages in the movies, they're not made for meaning, otherwise they won't sell. They're made to reach the LCD, the lowest common denominator, get you in the seat, and get you eating the popcorn, and buying the chocolate, and buying the action figures, and buying the swag. They're not made for thinkers. Okay, you want to watch a movie? That's not the topic of this conversation right now. But don't delude you, you might say. Like big battle I had like 20 years ago. He's now married, has kids, Baruch Hashem. There was a boy in Yeshiva who was addicted to Game Boys. You guys know what Game Boys are? These little Nintendo consoles. He was addicted to it. So I finally cornered him and I said, I'm not going to say his name. Do you realize you're wasting your time and your mental resources on this stupid little... He says, but you know what? It builds hand-eye coordination. If you pay to be a sniper, it builds hand-eye coordination. I say, at least be honest with yourself. You say, I want to waste my time, Rabbi. I need to relax. Like, you can't change unless you're honest. If you're honest with yourself, I like the movie. Great, watch the movie. Don't think it's Shakespeare. I think it's going to change your opinion. So Verner was against people reading books. Slow it down. Stop reading so much. And it's so good. Don't read the extra Rishon. Think. What did the previous Rishon say? Before I move on to more information, there's a deluge. Things are moving too fast. It's hard to think. It's hard to think long term when you're just struggling to make it. I remember I told you guys last week, I think. I was speaking to a Holocaust survivor and I said, what were you thinking during the Holocaust? Tell me about your processing. So some people did. Viktor Frankl, famous psychologist. But he said, thinking? We were in survival mode. I wasn't thinking. I was just putting one foot ahead of the other, just trying to make it to the end of the day. And those are extreme circumstances, obviously. But there's a little bit about survival mode, right? I sometimes see people, again, you can choose to be that person whose WhatsApps are constantly ringing. I cry for them in my heart. The constant buzz and the buzz and the buzz, and you feel a pressure to respond, to respond, to respond. It doesn't mean that you're more successful if more people want your attention. Attention is not success, not meaning. It's something you can fabricate. You can orchestrate how many people you correspond with, right? Like friend people in Nepal or something, whatever. A lot of people to talk to. It doesn't indicate success. Success isn't how many people like you or how many people want you. Success has to be internally driven, internally defined. And this is what the Jews were. It's hard. We can talk about them again. It's hard when you restrain. It's hard when you don't. All they want to hear about is when meeting for dinner. Find a lifestyle that gives you horizons of vision. And find people that can talk with you about vision, that can ask you, who will you be like in 5 years? Who will you be like in 10 years? Who will you be like in 150 years when you're not on this earth anymore? And what will your legacy be on this earth? What will your story be? What will your impact be? Have people that stretch your mind rather than shrink your mind, that stretch your life rather than shrinking your life. And when you're constantly on the run, think about Esav. We talked about this with Esav. He's just so busy. He's a man of verbs. He drinks. So of course he's going to sell the Bechor for some bees. Because you lose proportion. And you lose meaning. That's one reason they don't listen. Now let's see a different reason they don't listen. Let's turn to the Chizkuni. Just see a 3 or 4 reasons. This is fascinating. Noah also didn't? Chizkuni. Lo Shemuel Moshe. Nisyaru v'shmoel Moshe. It's not like they couldn't envision long term. They were afraid. What made them afraid? Mikotze ruach. What gave them kotze ruach? Avodah kasha. Shetziva alehem paro kvar tichbad ha'avodah l'anashim v'ayishu v'divrei shakir. They weren't afraid of work. They had already regulated themselves to work for 200 years. They were afraid to listen to Moshe because they were burned already by listening to Moshe. What happened in the end of Shlos? They listened to Moshe. And what was the outcome? Tichbar avodah, double work. They were traumatized by past failures. And they couldn't get past it. Trauma is an extreme form of fear. We all live with fear. Trauma is extreme. It's located in a particular moment, person, event, location. It creates a trauma. But the weaker form of trauma is fear. We all live with fears. How do you overcome fear? So you can have vision. It's one word, and it's not spoken about enough in most of Sparta, at all for that matter. But you need it to grow and to have long-term vision and to change. And you better have it if you want to succeed in life. It's called courage. You need to have courage. You need to have strength of will, strength of personality to deal with the fear of the unknown, because the price for change is walking into the unknown. And the greatest decisions in life require courage because you're going somewhere you're not. Think about marriage. There is no algorithm that will predict success in marriage. You stand there and you believe this is something I want to try because I believe it will work. And you summon your courage and you take that decision. Or making Aliyah. You don't ever know. No one's going to ever roll out the red carpet. All the great decisions in life means going somewhere you're not. And when you go somewhere you're not, you have to have courage because you're walking into the unknown. And courage doesn't mean you're not afraid. Courage means you make decisions even when you are afraid. Courage isn't the denial of fear. It's the ability to operate under its influence. So they just didn't have courage. No, they didn't have courage because they were burnt. They were traumatized. But even without trauma, it's hard to deal with fear unless you have courage. So the question is, how do you get courage? That's a hard one. Courage is probably one of the only traits you need to just pick it up from people. It's hard to describe. There's some traits like gratitude and curiosity and hard work, which you can describe. I can describe without personalizing what hard work is. I can talk about the trait called hard work without talking about it in the context of a human life. Hard work being putting forth a lot of effort, achieving, resource. I can talk about it in abstract. I can talk about many traits in abstract. There are a few traits you can't describe in abstract. You need to see it in people or to read about it in people. They'll never be people you meet. It's better if you meet people like that. But if you read about people of courage, You can also put, oh, this is how people express their courage when they're facing difficult situations, unknowns, risks. How do you take courageous decisions? That courage doesn't mean risky, doesn't mean foolhardy, but it means courageous. And how do you calibrate between foolish decisions and courageous decisions? It's not always easy. When people ask me what I saw in Rav Amital, because we spoke a lot in this room Friday night about Rav Lichtenstein primarily, one of the traits I saw in him, and if you read his biography, and I keep telling you, this biography, I'm batting 1,000. Everyone I've ever recommended this biography to has thanked me and said it's one of the best books I've ever read. So we're going to order on Amazon. Go ahead. It's called By Faith Alone. You guys know it. Ben Munato. He was a very courageous person. How did he become courageous? I think, when we spoke with him about this, his courage is because he faced death several times in the Holocaust. And at that point, nothing really ruffled his feathers. Nothing really overcame him. That's what I think it was. I never asked him that question. But I saw him act with courage. And courage is important to deal with fear. And you don't think that there's fear that impedes your growth in Avodas Hashem? I mean, just think about why you're not more dedicated in Avodas Hashem. At some point, it may be laziness, it may be confusion, it may be... But at some point, there's a lot of fear. You fear becoming more religious, because what does it mean? What's the price of becoming more religious? What's the price of... Not you, me. I'm also, at every stage of your life, you're trying to inch closer towards greater Avodas Hashem. And there's a deep, deep fear. What does that mean? What does it connote? How am I going to handle that? Will I be able to do more? Will I be able to? So at some point, you need faith, but you also need courage. And they just didn't have the courage because they were so obliterated by Pyro's intensification of the work. So that's the second reason they didn't listen. Not because they were so short of breath, because they were running and speeding and pressured. They didn't listen because they were burnt. And they just couldn't face those fears of entering a situation that's dangerous. Courage means you realize there's a risk, you realize there's a danger, you realize it's not known, but there's something great that's calling you. The third reason they didn't listen, let's take a look at, and we'll start with Medrash. Different take on Avodah Kasha. Just we'll end in a minute or two. What does the Medrash say? Hayakasha be a name, source number, hey, lifrosh me avodah zarah. Avodah kasha doesn't mean the labor. Because it was hard for them to walk away from paganism. Why is it hard to walk away from paganism? Just a different religion. Why is Judaism harder than paganism? Oh, it's a $1 million question. The answer is because you can't understand Hashem, and you can't understand the pagan idol, because you make it and you control it. Second of all, because the idol doesn't command you, you command the idol, you bribe the idol, you say nice things about the idol so that God will help you, and of course, serving a Kodesh Baruch Hu is anad dekodesh baruch hu. It's hard. Avodas Hashem is hard to live a life of mitzvos, to live a life of olam ha'chus shamayim, to live a life of trying to understand Hashem you know you'll never understand, to live a life of trying to understand the will of Hashem, and every sugya you can spend a lifetime on. At some point, you can't walk away from hard decisions in life. The hard decisions in life are always the best decisions in life. And if you keep taking the easy route, you'll end up in the world of mediocrity, because you're always going to take the easiest route possible. If you make hard decisions, then it'll be formative. Rabbi Akiva stands by the rock, and he sees that the water is sculpting the hard rock, and he says, if water sculpts hard rock, then Torah, which is hard, then it will sculpt my identity, be kalvachomer. If water sculpts rock and water is soft, and Torah is hard, it will sculpt my heart. Why is yeshiva so formative? Because it's hard. And the harder you make it, within reason, the more formative it will be. And the more you struggle, whether it's mental struggle, whether it's discipline struggle, whether it's schedule struggle, whether it's whatever struggle, that means it will be formative. And if you avoid struggle, then it will not touch you. What's the expression I said so many times before? Strong people, hard times make strong people make good times make weak people. So hard times make strong people. People that go through hardships and difficulties and makes them stronger. Okay, so no one in this room should know hard times to that degree. But struggle times and difficulty times and complex things, just they couldn't budge. It's easy to be a pagan. It's easy to make an idol and ask the idol to help me and not have commandments and be free for a life of immorality and choosing my life. It's harder to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanding, and I have to submit to those commands. Well, do you want hard and easy, or do you want meaningful and empty? Hard is meaningful. Choose between a life of happiness and meaning. You choose the first, you'll have neither. You choose the second, you'll probably have both. Let's go down.
Okay.
What?